Okay, we come now to discussion of biblical criticism in the last 200 years. In order to understand that, or you need to know a little bit about some of the terminology. Many of these people are known as higher critics. Now, for a long time in my life, I thought that that just meant that they were snobs. That they just thought they were better than everybody else. They were higher critics. They're not that dumb to describe themselves as smarter than everybody else. The idea of higher criticism, and that's why I stuck this map of the Jordan River in here, there is a lower criticism as well. And what this refers to is it's comparing, if you will, to the Jordan River. The higher critic is concerned with sources. Where did it come from? The lower critic is concerned with the outflow. And that is, the higher critic is concerned with authorship, the author sources, the motivations behind the book, where it was written, when it was written, and with the form or forms that were used in its writing. An area of study called form criticism. And you're familiar with a few of the forms in the Bible. A lot of the form critics have invented a lot more forms. Some of them perhaps legitimate, some of them sort of made up. You're familiar with Jesus used parables. You're familiar with the fact that many of the miracles that they chose were chosen not just because they referred to a miracle, but because they were teaching some lesson that the apostles wanted taught concerning the life of Christ and concerning his abilities. I don't have time to teach you any sermons about that. but you're familiar with the fact that there are various, you certainly don't know, and I doubt if I know all of the forms, but there are various forms that the text takes. The lower critic is concerned with textual criticism, that is, the accuracy of the text itself. You're aware of the fact that the early centuries of the Bible involved a handwritten text. And so what we want to know is the text that we have for Matthew in the many thousands of copies, handwritten copies of that, are there errors, are there mistakes? And so it's a very fastidious study of textual criticism. Is the text accurate? Is the translation of the text accurate? You're aware of the fact that there are a number of English translations. Are those translations accurate? And so these are the two various areas of study. And in this particular lesson, we're more concerned with the higher critics for the last 200 years. It's my opinion that they have been on the attack against the idea. Some of their major arguments that we're going to look at as we look at these 200 years are, first of all, they say, well, Jesus, they're not really sure he died. Some of them argue, well, he may have been drugged and revived. I'm serious as can be about this. Some of them say he may have been drugged up there before he went on the cross and revived when he came down. Others argue that he just passed out. He naturally passed out and was revived later on after the burial. They mistook him for being dead. He was revived later on. Others argue that he wasn't buried. You can see one of the things they're trying to work on with some of this, can't you? They're trying to explain that empty tomb. That gets to be one of the difficulties. So here they're attacking this empty tomb in another way. Jesus was not buried. He was left on the cross. And by the way, this would have been the normal Roman way of things, not to take that body down and bury it. That was kind of a waste of time and effort. It would make a lot better demonstration to the populace if it was just left up there. And this was their normal practice. A lot of times, of course, the family, friends, the Jewish law would have required that the body not be left up more than a day. Others argue that he was just left up there and eaten by the wild animals. of course, a priori, these men do not believe in the resurrection from the dead the same way you do. They'll use the term resurrection from the dead, but they don't mean resurrection from the dead the way you do. They do not believe in a bodily, physical resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. I went to a debate a few weeks ago with a brother who was a member of the church and a preterist. If you're familiar with some of the terminology in the Church of Christ, he was a Max King disciple accepting the 80-70 doctrine, which argues that Christ returned in AD 70, the resurrection took place in AD 70 at the destruction of Jerusalem, and the kingdom came then, and that there isn't any future resurrection. And that, yes, they do believe that we will go to heaven, but when you die, you just go. You know, your body's going to be left behind. They don't believe in a bodily resurrection. They believe that Jesus was resurrected bodily, but nobody else is going to be. So anyway, they follow through on this. So I asked them, or at least the fellow who was debating them, I asked them about some of the information we looked at last night, where you have quite a number of people writing, just a few years after 70 A.D., who were not in the Bible. They depend on early dating all the New Testament in order to accomplish this, by the way, if you wanted to know. And said, you know, why didn't Polycarp and Clement of Rome and all the, why didn't they know about this? They keep talking about the resurrection and the future return of the Lord. Didn't they know he already came? Didn't anybody tell them? And their answer to that was, well, all those guys were crazy anyway. Well, these men are doing roughly the same thing. There is a blanket, just without any rationale, miracles don't happen. And so any report of a miracle in your Bible just can't be true. Why? Because miracles don't happen. It's an a priori thing. It's just, they don't happen. So if you read about one, that's a myth. They made that up. They may have had a good reason to make it up, but they made it up. And the resurrection is one of those. And then fourth, that the witnesses, that is the early church, concocted. Now, they're not talking about the early church as in terms of 33, 35, 40 A.D. They realize that that's a little bit early for these guys to have said, aha, I've got a great idea. Let's make up a story about a resurrection that didn't happen. They're talking about people in the year 60, 70, 80, 100, 150 maybe, 200 A.D., having concocted the gospel. In order to do that, most of the gospels are assigned a much later date, much later, in the second century than normally would be considered. And the gospels are presented merely as the assembly of an earlier oral tradition. A lot of their form criticism deals with the passage of that oral tradition and questioning the legitimacy of it. And they try to read into it, where did they actually get it from, and which document did they copy Matthew from. Now, the problem with this is eyewitnesses. You know, it would be possible for these higher critics to make this work if there weren't any eyewitnesses. The eyewitnesses were not all caught up to heaven after the death of Jesus. An oral tradition would have to account if there's a false report of a miracle of Jesus. It would have to account for the presence of hundreds of eyewitnesses of the event. Can you imagine a false report of that feeding of the 5,000? You got at least 5,000 eyewitnesses. They knew whether there were wagons. You know, it wouldn't just been one wagon. Wagons, plural, hauling in a bunch of pizzas and fish to feed 5,000 people. They said, yeah, there was a chain of wagons. Jesus arranged it out there. I actually read one of these dudes where he argued that Jesus had the food stored in a cave and that he was standing there doing the hand behind the back routine, you know, passing it out, and they were all fooled. 5,000 idiots out there in the wilderness. Nobody who could say, you know, well, who is that behind that curtain over there, Dorothy? it's just an assumption of total idiocy on the part of these eyewitnesses. This period of oral tradition couldn't be a complete mythic fabrication. Some of the difficulties of a church origination of the Gospels are how we to account for a different standard before and after the resurrection. In other words, there were some things different before and after the resurrection. Why did they do that? If the entire story was concocted later, wouldn't they have had the same thing before? Let me see if I can give you the example. The church was heavily involved with the Holy Spirit. This was evidenced by speaking in tongues in a large measure in the early church. How many cases of speaking in tongues do you find in the Gospels? None. Why? If the church wrote all this and made it all up, why wouldn't they have referred to the apostles speaking in tongues before the resurrection? Because they sure did it after the resurrection. If the later church created, why did they make the distinction? If there were no historical perspective, they would reflect the same in both periods. Instead of their absence in the Gospels, proves the sources for the life of Christ were not to be found in the apostolic period. The source was earlier. The source was Jesus Christ himself. The source was in that period. Now, what I want to do now, we're going to begin this review. And one of the first errors the higher critics proposed were fictitious lives of Jesus. These were, they claimed they were fictitious, but they presented these ideas. They speculated quite a bit on the internal motivations of Jesus. They postulated a lot of secret organizations, usually the Essenes. Those guys are good for nearly anything. We did, especially 200 years ago, we didn't have any idea really what the Essenes were about 200 years ago. So they could be up to all kinds of skullduggery, you know, meeting out there with hoods and burning things and doing strange things out in the desert. So you could just accuse them of anything, and Jesus could have been a part of it. They conjectured early on that Jesus didn't die. They were very poor scholars, and there were many fictional elements. This was a part of Protestant liberalism. It was dated about 1780 to 1840. But this is where it began, and these are some of the authors that were involved in that effort. From there, it progressed to classical Protestant liberalism, dated roughly from 1800 to World War I. So roughly for a century this was going on. These people denied the gospel accounts. They just simply denied them. Jesus is spoken of in glowing terms as an example for the living. Does that give you an idea that maybe the resurrection isn't exactly the thrust of this? And, you know, the resurrection is just a wonderful example for the living. You're going to live to do better. Miracles were treated as absolutely non-historical. They rejected them. It was just beneath them to consider they were either conceived as rationalized operations of nature. Let me give you some examples. For instance, when Jesus walked on the water, actually what he did was he just happened to know where a series of paving stones were just under the surface of the water. And so it looked like he was walking on the water, but he just was following a carefully arranged path out there on the water. Okay. Except for the fact that the gospel account says that he was walking past them. He didn't go to walk to them. He was walking past them on the Sea of Galilee and beating them when they killed him down. But so they missed a few points, but that's the sort of explanation that's given. They're rationalizing the events. At least they accepted the fact that the events happened, if they didn't accept the fact that they were miracles. Others simply identified the miracles as a myth entirely, and this, of course, undermines the entire historical basis of the Gospels. Their theology was very dogmatic. They ignored Jesus' claim to deity. Jesus was a man. He was an exemplary man, and they would preach about him, and they'd probably use the phrase Son of God quite a bit, throwing that around. But they didn't mean that he was the Son of God. They didn't mean that he preexisted life on this earth. They didn't mean what Philippians says, that he counted not the being on an equality with God a thing to be grasped. They didn't mean any of those things. He was simply God in the same sense that perhaps you and I are in some cases referred to as God. These people held an evolutionary anthropology that involved humans reaching higher levels of consciousness. Sort of an outgrowth of Emerson and Thoreau and that sort of school of thought, suggesting you could just rise above all the troubles of this world. And Jesus was a wonderful example of one who had risen above his lowly status and serves as an example to all mankind about how they can do this same sort of thing. The problem was World War I. England lost, I believe it was about a third to a half of the young men in the age group of 20 years old. So did France, so did Germany in the First World War. It was just incredibly brutal. We don't study about the First World War very much anymore. We don't realize what profound effect it had on these people. It just crushed any notion of anybody rising above anything. If you've tried to look at the mentality of Nazi Germany, you need to look at the First World War. You need to understand how that profoundly affected their philosophy, their theology, and their thinking. Any notion of the intrinsic goodness of man was just absolutely lost in the First and Second World Wars, so that nobody was going to be talking about the rising above and how we can do such wonderful things. This was followed by neo-orthodoxy in its thinking. Karl Barth, who's here on the left, is the leading proponent of neo-orthodoxy, or was. His period of influence was about 1918 to 1970. He emphasized God's sovereignty. God was powerful overall. A lot of people liked him because he talked about God a lot. He realized the reality of sin. There was a lot of these guys who weren't doing that. He de-emphasized the need for any consideration of the historical Jesus. It just wasn't necessary. Rudolf Bultmann, who's up here, he was another leading proponent, perhaps better known. In his 1941 essay, The New Testament Mythology, he popularized the theological methodology of demythologization. That is, you need to study the Bible so you can discover which parts are the myths. This resulted in a de-emphasis on the need for any evidential foundation of faith. That whole notion of the leap of faith that you've got to make to be a Christian comes out of these movements. There's no evidence. There's no need studying the historical records. These guys believe the Bible was largely composed of myth. Biblical indications of the supernatural were, while an indicator of their belief, this is what they believed in, simply not to be understood today in any literal sense. It just couldn't be. They were just wrong. If it was true that they believed this, then they were just wrong. The transcendent language itself was significant in itself, should be reinterpreted for its existential meaning for the present day living. So they were existentialists, Christian existentialists, and the Bible was profitable for that sort of thing, and little else. One of the positions involved is whether Jesus ever lived. And these men were writing about the same time as Bultmann and others, J.A. Wells and Michael Martin. And if you go to the Goodwill or some other bookstore, you'll be able to pick up a lot of their books. Real cheap, which is kind of nice. They argued that Paul's writings have few historical details. The Gospels were written later. They shifted, they said, to a recent life of Jesus. In other words, Jesus actually lived later than 30 A.D. Paul's letters would have more details, they argue. This shift, the Gospels being written after Paul, suggests that the church was revising things and making changes in positions. Early Christian confessions, some of the difficulties with this, and we're going to look at these in detail this afternoon. Early Christian confessions in Paul reflect earlier positions held by Christians, and they can validate most of the key elements of the Gospels as existing roughly about the same time. For instance, Paul lived in the first century. He refers to the contemporaries of Jesus. He refers to Peter. He refers to James. He refers to Peter, James, and John in Galatians. Most of the 500 that he names in 1 Corinthians 15 were still alive, he said, when he wrote. And so you can't shift the life of Jesus later in the century. You can't get the church making a shift to revise things. Paul was there. The witnesses were there. And he knew them. There were difficulties with these things. They claimed that the Christian church borrowed from the mystery religions. If you're familiar with Greek and Roman religions, there were several mystery religions that began to proliferate among the Greeks and Romans roughly about this period of time. This is just a big smoke screen that they're trying to kick up. One of the things they're trying to do is they're trying to explain the resurrection. And by the second century, lo and behold, some of the mystery religions in Greek and Roman theology had begun to create some idea of a resurrection. But none of the mystery religions claimed a resurrection till the second century. And in Palestine, they just didn't have a whole lot of that going on. Now, if you were sitting over in Rome or downtown Athens, maybe so. But if you're sitting in Jerusalem, where these apostles spent most of their life, in Palestine, there just isn't any reference, hardly at all, to the mystery religions to borrow from. And, of course, as we already indicated, they were too late. This view, suggesting that these things took place, requires on late dating the New Testament. It would require that there is no source, get this, no source later than 90 A.D. In other words, none of Paul, none of the Gospels are written before 90 A.D. And most of the scholars I've shown you give rough dates similar to what I just showed you. We're going to look at that chart in a minute. They refused to acknowledge normal historical sources. Remember those we looked at last night? They refused to... I mean, here you have men who are quoting in 90 A.D., already quoting from existing books, that these guys say, no, no, no. No, those are being written in 90 A.D. And so Clement of Rome, they must have mailed him an advance copy or something because he's already quoting from it. From Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and other of the letters of Paul, they ignore those historical copies. So what they're requiring is they are obviously requiring a move of all these books and all this authority back roughly to this point on the chart, at least to this point or further back. This view has primarily been advanced by Rudolf Bultmann and his disciples. He says we can, where he tries to place limitations on the historical Jesus. He was historical, but in a limited sense. We can know, he can know almost nothing concerning the life and personality of Jesus. That pretty well challenges the historicity of Jesus. Was he a real person? Does the Bible really refer to him? We just showed you yesterday that there were a number of people, both Christian and non-Christian, early back in the century, who were aware of Christ, aware of his influence, speaking of it. But Bultmann says, pontificates, we can know almost nothing concerning the life and of Jesus. The history of the resurrection, what did it actually occur, is rejected as a myth. It simply was a myth. Some of the problems. The New Testament claims to be based on historically accurate accounts. That sort of places a difficulty. The rejection of miracles by Bultmann and all these others was absolutely without any investigation. It's a priori. It's without any thought. It's just, there can't be miracles. Yeah, it's just a presupposition. They have a very faulty historical analysis. The form criticism, by the way, which Bultmann came up with, where he tries to identify hundreds of different sources by virtue of some unknown distinctions in the documents themselves, in little snippets of the documents. Most historians simply laugh at that idea. That idea, any ancient document, the writings of Plato, the writings of Homer, you could just trash them up. You don't use form criticism much on anything else. Secular ancient documents would have to be examined for accurate historical knowledge in spite of their attempts to moralize. Literature such as the Gospels are very unique ancient books. There isn't anything like the Gospels anywhere else. There just aren't any other examples that you can cite of them. Much of the book of Acts can be confirmed by independent historical sources. You know whether Festus was there, you know where Agrippa was, you know all of those events that are being named and cited. So much of the book of Acts can be independently confirmed. The Gospels, in fact, are written very close in date to the events they're talking about. They're not centuries removed from those events. So that we're able to say the New Testament is textually verified. It's not as if, you know, we're depending on documents written in the 1500s, copies written in that time. There are thousands of manuscript copies compared to a very few for most other historical documents. They suggest that there are no non-biblical sources for Jesus. That's why we spent last night showing you the non-biblical sources for Jesus. But this is a very popularly held view that nobody else refers to Jesus. Who knows whether he ever actually existed or not? It reflects a very profound ignorance of the facts. There weren't any speedy communications during this time, at least as we would recognize speed. There would have been more written, I believe, concerning Jesus in the first century if there had been speedy communication, if there was a newspaper every morning that could quickly be distributed all over the state of New York. Why? We hear that somebody rises from the dead. I can assure you there will be a tabloid in your grocery store tomorrow that will have pictures and a four-page story on the fellow who rose from the dead down there. And if it actually did happen, it'll be on the New York Times, and they'll bring one of those up here for you. But they didn't have that at this time. His humble background gives little reason why really much would have been noticed about him during his life outside Palestine. He would have been dismissed simply as another Jewish pretender to be king of the Jews, and so largely ignored, although perhaps the records during his life would have been there.